Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to our participants around the globe. And I apologize that I'm a bit soft-spoken today. I've got a cold. Just some administrative notes before we get started. This will be our last MicroLynx webinar for the year. We'll be taking off December for the holidays, but we're looking forward to having even more fruitful knowledge exchange coming in 2018. I'd also like to remind you that there were some polls at the beginning, and also please give us your feedback on this seminar at the end polls, which will occur after today's conversation. And then finally, please look out for a follow-up email that will have a link to the recording of this webinar, the transcript, and more helpful documents. My name is Laura Meisner. I'm an Economic Recovery and Markets Advisor, and I work with USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance, or OFDA. Today, we'll be talking about efforts to support markets and livelihoods amid the world's largest humanitarian crisis in Syria. Cumulatively, the U.S. government has spent more than $7.5 billion in humanitarian assistance for the Syrian complex emergency response since fiscal year 2012. This includes more than $1.5 billion in the past fiscal year, 2017, for assistance both inside Syria, as well as relief efforts to support Syrian refugees in Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and Egypt. This assistance includes some incredibly difficult-to-reach areas and places where markets are distorted or not functioning properly. For example, in October, the Syrian Democratic Forces announced the recapture of Araqqa in northern Syria from ISIS, which had controlled the city since January of 2014. Findings from an assessment in early October indicated that the city had no functioning bakeries, a single functioning market, no healthcare services, no electricity, and insufficient safe water to drink. Or in southern Syria, more than 393,000 people reside in the Syrian government-besieged eastern Ghouta region of Reef Damascus, where there's extremely limited commercial and humanitarian access, contributing to reduced availability of essential goods, increasing staple commodity prices, deteriorating humanitarian indicators. In September, a 42-truck convoy delivered assistance to 25,000 people in three besieged towns. This was the first humanitarian assistance to reach populations there in more than 3 months. All across Syria, humanitarian organizations are continuing to support people's needs across a variety of sectors. This includes helping people resume their livelihoods or start new livelihood activities, even amidst the imperative to continue and expand life-saving assistance. Today, we have with us representatives from two such agencies, Kelly Van Hoosen, a humanitarian assistance specialist at Global Communities, and Vi Krishnan, who's a cash and markets expert and regional economic opportunities advisor at Mercy Corps. We're very grateful to them for sharing their organization's experiences, and we're excited to learn from their efforts. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Kelly. Thank you.
I think that it was just turned over to Kelly. Kelly, unfortunately, we can't hear you speaking. And to our participants, thanks for bearing with us. This is the power and the sometimes the penalty of international webinars. Kelly, right now we are not able to hear you. If we don't get you coming in here in the next minute or so, hello, who is that? You, Kelly?
What's the question? Hello?
Oh, well, I think that they just tried to turn it over to Kelly. Is that right, Ahmed?
Hello, can you
hear me? Right. Is this Kelly?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now, Kelly. Okay, great. Over to you, Kelly.
All right, great. Thanks. Sorry about that. I'll just get started by talking a little bit about Global Communities and the work that we're doing in Syria, and then get into more of the details about why we do what we do, and why we think what we think the values of the approach are in terms of supporting livelihoods in a crisis such as Syria. So just very briefly, we have been working in Syria for about 3 years. And we support small-scale farmers, and we do our work is focused on two elements. So one is supporting immediate food security, and the second is supporting longer-term market recovery. So on the food security side, we support small-scale farmers through humanitarian assistance, include providing seeds, tools, and fertilizer to small-scale farmers, and those are generally subsistence-level farmers. So those that are farming to feed their families and then give the remaining crop for sale. And then our second element of the work that we do is focused on the larger value chain and the larger agricultural market recovery within Syria. And that is focused on the wheat value chain primarily, and we'll get into some of the reasons around that. But some of those activities focus on wheat cultivation, and that's, again, supporting the farmers to be able to grow wheat. Fire control teams, and that's because of some of the risks and some of the impacts that the war has had on wheat cultivation. And that involves us training fire control teams that are essentially ready on standby during the height of the harvest season to be able to put out fires for the wheat fields. And those fires are typically caused either by, you know, drought conditions, which are fairly typical, or attacks, artillery, bombs, et cetera, from the regime that end up causing fires that can damage an entire wheat crop. We also do irrigation rehabilitation in support of wheat cultivation as well. So some of the photos you see there are just cleaning out the irrigation channels that were previously maintained by the Syrian government to ensure that people can irrigate their fields. And then post-harvest production, and that's something that's newer for Syria, something as activities that we've just started within about the last 6 months. But that is looking at the wheat processing, so milling of the wheat, and then processing the flour into bread. So we're working to both on the infrastructure rehabilitation side to restore mills and bakeries, and then to be able to support all of those actors along that value chain in terms of farmers getting the wheat to the mills, and then the mills to be able to transport the flour to the bakeries, and the bakeries to be able to process the flour into bread. So it's a little bit of the entire value chain, stretching from immediate humanitarian assistance and ensuring that people have some additional food to eat, as well as supporting that larger livelihood and the agriculture value chain, again, focused on wheat. So why wheat? And let's get into some of that in terms of why we chose that particular sector within the agricultural economy of Syria. Largely because it's one of the largest components of the agricultural sector. Agriculture in general contributed as much as 27% of GDP pre-war. Syria was one of the largest exporters of wheat throughout the region, and a number of varieties of wheat were exported and used for various things, for bread production and others. And if you talk to Syrian staff, they speak to wheat as largely an identity crop within Syria. So it has practical value, again, because it can contribute to such a large portion of the GDP, particularly in the rural economy. And it's also something, a symbol of pride for the region in terms of Syria being a producer of a large amount of wheat, and a producer of a number of different varietals of wheat, and a large exporter of the crop. It's interesting, too, that particularly in the early stages of the conflict, there were a number of agencies and monitoring agencies, research firms, that were tracking wheat production, and bread prices as a metric of conflict. And that was, you know, intended to track because bread and wheat production is such a staple throughout Syria, that was really used as a metric to determine the impact of the crisis. You know, if bread prices were skyrocketing, if wheat production was declining, and the impact of the conflict then on that particular sector as a metric for the entire country and the entire conflict. Pre-war, and another reason we have selected the wheat value chain to focus on in terms of Syria is that it was pre-war, it was extremely controlled by the Syrian government. And to say that, you know, a lot of countries have various levels of government control in certain sectors of production, I think to say that the Syrian government had a lot of influence or impact on control of the wheat value chain is not even giving it the full level of control or the full picture of how, to what degree the government was able to control the wheat production. So The Syrian government essentially subsidized the cost of all inputs, all seeds, all fertilizer, maintained all irrigation canals, had cost recovery schemes for water, for farmers. So all of the cost of inputs were subsidized and controlled by the government of Syria. The government also guaranteed the harvest price it paid farmers, and determined the amount and type and varietal of wheat that each farmer would produce. So you have essentially a system where every season, the government extension, agricultural extension agents would meet with each local farmer in their area. After calculating kind of the total metric ton that the government, that the country would like to produce for that year, divided up among regions and varietals for export, for not for export, for consumption. And then each agricultural extension agent would meet with an individual farmer and instruct him essentially as to how much of what varietal he would plant, provide the seeds and the inputs at a subsidized rate, agree on the or tell him the price that the government would pay for the harvest and at what quantity, and then that's what the farmer would plant. The government also owned the largest flour mills and bakeries throughout the country. While there were some privately functioning mills and bakeries, the government owned the majority of those. The government also fixed the market price of bread. So really all aspects of that, of the wheat value chain was extraordinarily controlled by the government, and the farmers had little to no say in terms of what they would plant, when they would plant it, or the price or profit that they would make. You guys hear me again? I think I was just muted and then unmuted. Okay, I'll continue. So in terms of that, in terms of working with the wheat value chain and then with the farmers, post-conflict, that system essentially collapsed because the government no longer was able to control, particularly in non-government held areas. The government was no longer able to control that agricultural sector to the same extent. And in terms of the conflict, just the impact of war on the wheat value chain and on farming and the agricultural sector in general. I won't go through each of these bullets, but just to give you a sense of the impact, 7 wheat varietals lost. Again, Syria was a large producer and exporter of wheat of a number of varieties, and 17 of those were lost just because of the war, because so much of the crop and the seeds were destroyed. Estimated losses to the agricultural sector now exceed $16 billion estimated. And again, value of destroyed crops estimated at over 900 million, livestock sector. And then in terms of a human impact on that, 90% of Syrian families are now spending over half of their income on food. And that's, again, largely due to the destruction of the agricultural sector and farmers' inability to be able to grow crops and to produce the harvest that they need because they are so... They've been used to a system where all of the inputs have been heavily subsidized for so long that farmers are unable to afford the real market cost of inputs. Hence why Global Communities is looking at providing some of those initial subsidized inputs as a way to allow farmers to restart their livelihoods and to ensure that they are able to grow wheat and to restart that that livelihood. And the way forward, again, given the heavy degree of government control, prior to the war, you essentially have a very nascent private sector agricultural economy that's struggling to grow in spite of the conflict, and to to learn how to become profitable and how to become privatized in a way without that degree of government control and subsidy and price control throughout that value chain. So our strategy has been to identify specific points along that value chain that we're able to support throughout the process. So again, simple things such as providing inputs that are allowing farmers to restart and to replant their crop, to repairing the actual infrastructure for the mills and bakeries, and then trying to support some of the other maybe lesser looked at aspects of the wheat value chain, but things that are still critical, such as the fire control, just as a way to ensure that the harvest is actually fruitful, and that farmers aren't losing crops unnecessarily. But a lot of that ends up being NGOs stepping in to NGOs and other private actors stepping in to take on a lot of the government role that was played pre-conflict. And I think one of the challenges that we still face is looking at, how will that local ownership take place, and who ultimately will take responsibility for a lot of those components that were previously managed by government, whether it's local councils, whether it's private owners that end up managing the bakeries, whether that's various community committees that are established, and that's something that's still developing and still varies across the country, depending on the specific location within Syria. But in talking to a lot of our Syrian staff as well, there's not an expectation that even post-conflict, that the Syrian agricultural sector, and particularly in terms of wheat production, will return to heavy government control, regardless of the outcome of the conflict. Even if the Syrian government ends up controlling the country again, there's not a strong sense that the government would return to controlling the agricultural sector to the same degree, because ultimately it became unsustainable and unprofitable, and there was a reason for its collapse aside from the conflict itself. So what we're really focusing on now is, again, supporting various points along that value chain, and trying to encourage that nascent private sector to grow and to strengthen, to be able to continue on post-conflict. And just one of the kind of figures that we've looked at, after the 3 years of providing the initial inputs. So an input of approximately $300, and that's the seeds, tools, fertilizer, et cetera, yield an average of $1,200 to $2,500 in income for the farmers. And that's for one planting season, which then enables them to purchase inputs and plant again for the following year, and to purchase food and other items that they need for their families. So we do see it as a way that we're enabling farmers to restart their livelihoods, and that it is a one-time input that really is sustainable and really fosters a sustainable livelihood recovery. Again, as a larger part of, or as a small part of restoring the larger value chain for the wheat sector, and trying to support that private sector and the privatization of the agricultural economy within Syria. With that, and I will turn it over, I think, back to Laura.
Great. Actually, Kelly, I'm going to take over. I'm going to spare Laura because she's got a cold. Hi, everyone. My name is Vi, and I'm going to follow on from what Kelly talked about. There are some common points, but before we get into that, I'm going to quick test. You see these polls in front of you. These are unfortunately mandatory. You have to take them. So I would like you to take a couple of seconds to really quickly respond to these three poll questions. First one, is it feasible for active livelihood programs inside Syria? In 7 years into the conflict, what do you think people rely on for better welfare? And the third one, if I told you that people are finding innovative ways to adapt their livelihoods, where do you think is the most likely choice, right? I like that someone has actually voted yes, but you'd have to be mad to try. Someone has actually said this is a trick question, I prefer not to answer. Nice. It's an audience with a good sense of humor. I like it. Okay. We're going to give it a couple of seconds to see if there's anyone else who's not taken the quiz. And I will tell you the answers to this, so we will come back to this at the very end, so remember what your responses were. Adam, if everybody's finished, I think it's okay for us to move into the presentation. Fantastic. Okay. So, oops. All right. Let's get started there. Really, this sums up what I want to talk about, right? This plan versus reality. We all are familiar with that situation. What we tell the donor we're going to do in our proposal, that's our plan. And our lessons learned at the end of this whole program is us being bruised and battered and licking our wounds and reaching that goal, right? Our reality. So what I want to tell you the story about today is one of Mercy Corps' livelihood programs inside a besieged location inside Syria, and what our plan was and what our reality eventually turned out to be, right? Here's what we planned. It was a rural besieged community inside Syria. So when I say besieged, basically for those of you who are not very familiar with the term, it's all the primary access routes into the community are controlled by checkpoints, and those could be government of Syria checkpoints, those could be opposition held checkpoints, but basically it means that goods coming into this location are controlled, and it's not always that these markets are fully functioning, right? It's not a free market. So we looked at a rural besieged area inside Syria, and we found that there were a large number of vulnerable households that needed support with meeting their own food security. We also looked at the previous skills of these livelihoods, these locations, and we found that most of these households had been previously reliant on livestock-related livelihoods. So we knew that there was past skills and experience in this location. And finally, we looked at the markets to say, okay, if we do a livestock program, is there going to be, are people going to be able to sell their produce in the market? And we found that there was a gap between the livestock produce, the supply, and the demand in the market, and I think this was about 80%. So we said, based on this, what we proposed to the donor, we said, we're going to provide livestock assets, like cows and chicken and sheep and rabbits, to vulnerable households, and it will have multiple impacts, right? One is it will help, the produce will help these households improve their own nutritional status, improve their food security. The additional produce can be sold in the market because there is a market for it. And finally, by increasing the amount of supply, which was currently in short supply at this point, we would be effectively able to bring down the high prices of livelihood products in this market. Great. We did have one conundrum, though, very early on. Those that we were looking at as vulnerable, and I think as humanitarian actors, this is quite common, right? We say we want to be able to look at the poorest families. They are vulnerable, but they're not eligible. And when I say that, what I mean is to be able to maintain a livestock, there were some minimum criteria we wanted to look at, i.e., did these people have some kind of safe shelter where they could house these animals, like a barn? Did they have access to water? Did these specific households had past income, past skills and experience to be able to maintain this livestock so that they could continue to sell these products in the market? Did they have the market linkages? And this was the first conundrum. People that were vulnerable were not really eligible, and those that were eligible with all these physical infrastructure and these skills did not really fall into the vulnerability criteria, right? I will get into how we address that in a second. Does everybody know what a curve ball is? For those of you that play cricket, like in my country, we also call it a googly. Basically, it means a ball. You expect the ball to come in a certain direction, but the ball spins and comes in a completely different direction and takes you off the bright, right? So we had a curve ball. We sent the proposal off to the donor, and they said, well, this is all well and good, but tell us why cows, why chicken? Tell us, why are you doing these specific livestock? Why would you choose cows over chicken? What is the cost and benefit of each particular type of animal that you want to provide, right? And to be very honest, I think I rolled my eyes a little bit when I read that request. I was only happy that it was not a chicken or egg question. It was just a cow or chicken question, right? So we're not one to back down from a fight. So we said, okay, you want a cost-benefit analysis? We're going to give you one. And when I say we, I mean my colleague Joe, who's sitting in and listening to this webinar. So Joe basically sat down to do the cost-benefit analysis. And to be able to do that, we needed to put down not just the price of the animal, but also the price of maintaining that animal's health until such time the produce became viable to be able to sell in the market, the benefit part of it. So essentially, we looked at very basic things. We said, okay, What does a cow need food? It needs fodder. It needs veterinary products to be able to maintain its health, right? And as we looked at just these two inputs for the cows, we realized that our cost benefit was never going to make it. Why? Because the cost of fodder was extremely high. So we started to dig into that a little bit more. So why is the cost of fodder really high? We found out because fodder was being imported. Why was it being imported from outside? Because it was not being locally produced. Why wasn't fodder being locally produced? Because wheat farmers basically didn't have the capacity to grow their produce, right? So as we started to look at just some of these inputs and the cost of these inputs, we realized that there were larger sort of market failures that if we didn't address, we were never really going to make this program feasible or sustainable. The saving grace was that there was still a market demand for produce. But here's the catch. The traders were buying this milk, but taking it outside and selling it outside. So, anything that had to be brought in, like if they were bringing in milk or cheese, it was being imported, and again, the price was very high. I don't blame them. People were really poor. They couldn't afford to buy the milk and these products anyway. So traders were basically taking it outside, right? So this was an additional challenge that we were looking at. So in effect, really what we were thinking about is that market system. Now, this is a very basic market system, and I know lots of market system people out there. I know this is a very basic market system, but as humanitarians, this was our first stumbling block. We knew that if we had to make it feasible to provide this livestock and the benefit side of this livestock, we would have to concurrently address challenges around inputs like feed. We would have to address this issue of veterinary medication, supplies, the availability, cost, and we would also have to address this challenge that I talked about earlier, which was this vulnerability eligibility conundrum, right? And we would have to be addressing all of this in We would have to be addressing all of this in parallel to be able to make this program work. Any James Bond fans out there? This one's for you guys. Shaken but not stirred. What we realized is that we couldn't actually do all of this at the same time. So we took a step back and we said, right, we still need to address this, but at this point, the only thing we can do for the first 6 months, because we only had 6 months, so we needed to come up with a more feasible intervention. So we said, at this point, the phase one will still be a direct intervention. It will focus on the food security of these vulnerable households, but we will address the issue around input supplies at a later point, but for now, we're going to focus on food security, right? So we were bringing in fodder we were directly providing the fodder. With the veterinary supplies, we had a slightly more convoluted solution. What we said is we're going to hire these veterinary pharmacists to be trainers on our program, and they will monitor the health of these animals. They can train beneficiaries on how to identify any preventable diseases so that they can take action at the right time. And this would have the additional benefit of recapitalizing these veterinary suppliers, because as smaller businesses, they'd basically have to shut down their businesses. So to be able to recapitalize them, to be able to give them some money, to be able to restart their business while also working on this program, would help them not just to get access to cash, but also give them some lead time to restock, build up those linkages that they had lost during the crisis. Right? And on the vulnerability eligibility one, we came up with what I think is an interesting model. It was a sort of hybrid model. We said, let's give this cow, let's make this hybrid model of a sort of owner-raiser, right? So the vulnerable households do still own this animal, but while we are building their skills to be able to interact with the market, and meet the other physical requirements like having a barn, etc., the raisers would be the ones that would be taking care of these animals. The raisers would be paid like a cash for work for, you know, just the first 6 months of the program when we were implementing it. And they would also be able to get a share of the produce. The bulk of the produce would go to the vulnerable households, a part of which they could sell, a part of which they could use for their own consumption. But the raisers would get not just this monthly sort of cash for 6 months, but also a part of the produce, right? This was how we, and to be very honest, the phase one, the direct intervention, we did really well on food consumption scores. If I remember correctly, I think we started at an acceptable of close to 0 or 1%, and we went up to 86% by the end of that 6 months. And I think that that was great. But there are two challenges here that I want to talk about right away. One is this hybrid model. At the end of the 6 months, I think the hybrid model was a really good, innovative idea. At the end of the 6 months, the vulnerable household gained full control of the animal. And as we're monitoring it, as we monitored it later, only half of those owner-raiser relationships still continued, meaning 50% of those relationships broke down and only 50% of those relationships survived. I would love to tell you why some of those survived and some of those didn't, but I don't have that information right now. I do want to say that this is one shortcoming, is that we've created a good model, what we think is a good model, and we know half of it has worked. Why some of it has worked, why some of it hasn't, we don't know just yet, but we're looking into it. The other is the question around veterinary pharmacists. During this program, what I didn't talk about is we also introduced livestock like rabbits. Rabbits had never been done in this location before, but we said, okay, let's give it a try. Let's see how rabbits fare in this location. So we introduced something new. But halfway through that program, there was a large outbreak of disease, and we lost a lot of the rabbits that we had provided. Now, what we realized that veterinary pharmacists, there were so few of them that their capacity was very stretched. And we had basically introduced large numbers of 3 or 4 different types of livestock into this community, but we didn't really consider from the supply-demand lens, are the veterinary pharmacists, do they have the capacity to be able to actually serve this large number of animals? So I think that was a huge missed opportunity for us, something that we do need to consider, right? We did, previously I talked about the phases. The next 6 months of the program did focus its attention on the market actors. And we primarily chose the supply chain actors. We did have a bit of a debate about, should we do supply chain or should we look at the value chain? Should we look at the milk into cheese into other products? But we realized that unless we actually address the supply side of of this market, there was going to be no product to add value to, right? So in the next phase, we created linkages through vouchers between veterinary pharmacists and the vulnerable households that had received livestock. And we were also looking at rejuvenating the local fodder production. So we provided cash to farmers to be able to restart their wheat production. And as Kelly explained in her presentation, wheat is, it's not that we just give them cash and, you know, miraculously tomorrow they start producing wheat, they start producing fodder. But this was our way of starting to involve more market system support, right? So looking at addressing fodder and veterinary products, which were the two primary challenges we'd had on our program. I do want to say, still going with James Bond, neither shaken nor stirred, the numbers you see in front of you are the net profit that we calculated for each cow and for each flock of chicken, right? And here again, the cost-benefit analysis that we were dreading so much was super relevant for us because it actually helped us track how we were doing against what we had projected. And you see the red line is what we projected for each cow, that by month 5 or month 6, it would still be breaking even. But by month 5, the cows had actually the net profit. So when I say net profit, we're talking about including the cost of the animal and the inputs and the sale of the produce was about $500 per cow. And the chicken, we did actually much better. We actually started out thinking chicken, the first flock would probably start about $80 in terms of profit, but chicken we actually did a lot better and we started about $620. I think I'm reading that number correctly, I hope so. Yes. And like I said, in the final phase, the next 6 months, we are going to be looking at the value chain side of things. So phase one, intervention, food security. Phase two, looking at supply chain. Phase three, looking at value-added products. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're looking at this and saying, well, this isn't really market systems. And I know a lot of the audience out there is, there's a mix between humanitarians and market systems. And where does this all fit in? So while we do want to think about the market system and the actors that support these key interventions, even if it's humanitarian interventions that we're doing, is it actually feasible for us to take a facilitation approach to incentivize suppliers to outreach into these communities and create those linkages? At this point, not yet. I'm not saying it's not possible, but not right now because it is still a seller's market. There are very few large buyers that are still able to operate, large sellers that are able to operate, and they are able to monopolize the availability and price of goods in the market, right? Trust is still a scarce commodity. Surprisingly, business-to-business lending is still taking place inside Syria. And I will tell you how I know that, but the point is that the lending that's happening is very constrained because of the economic hardship. People don't know if the people they lend to are going to repay them back or not, right? Producers don't really have negotiating power. But here I'm going to diverge and tell you a little story of the chicken, which was with the milk, with the cows, we were actually taking a part of that produce from the vulnerable household and selling it in the market for them. Because our idea was, while they get the skills to sell in the market themselves, we will do the selling for them. With the people that we provided the chickens to, we didn't actually do any of that. But without our prodding or without us telling them to do anything, they found, all the chicken raisers formed these sort of loose alliances among themselves to be able to bargain and negotiate for a better price for their produce with the vendors. And I think that that's a really important takeaway for us, is that we don't always have to try and control every single element of the program. If we provide some skills and capacities, people might surprise us by doing what we completely do not expect them to do. And the last question around targeting versus impact. And I think this is important because with such huge humanitarian needs inside Syria, we need to find better ways of, we do need to target the most vulnerable, but they currently still do not have the capacity and the skills to interact with the market. So how can we create more impact for these specific households? And again, going back to that hybrid model where two households within the same community were able to benefit from one animal, for me is double the benefit at the same price, right? And I would love to dig further into that model to see how that works for people that are still continuing to maintain that relationship. Top takeaway, life saving versus better life saving. I think this is an easy one for me to talk about. When we talk about humanitarian aid, we think about food. We think about everything that's life-saving, and I think that's important. There are some areas where you do need that. But for me, addressing household food security, it's not just about something short-term. We also need to be saying, how can we continue to address this food security for longer, right? Better life-saving would be involving market actors and supporting them. Phased approach, I think, again, this is a learning from this program. You can't do it all in 6 months. So think about what can you feasibly achieve in 6 months, but address those root causes like the supply chain issues. Just do it in the next phase. Market price is a logical place to start. And I know we have a zillion tools out there for market assessment, but logically and personally, I find looking at market prices and looking at the fluctuations in market prices, or even looking at why is the cost of this particular input so high, a good place to start your inquiry into what is happening with this market. Is there a larger market failure that we need to be thinking about? It's a starting point, right? My fourth one, don't try to control for everything. We already talked about this, about the question around us selling the milk as opposed to producers creating their own set of alliances for the chicken. And my personal favorite, don't roll your eyes at donor requests. right? The cost-benefit analysis actually turned out to be one of the most useful exercises that we did. I'm going to stop for a second, Adam, if you just... Fantastic. Okay. Okay. Great. I can see that I'm looking at the second response around markets. What do you think people rely on better welfare? Markets 24.1, social capital 62.9. And let's look at the last response. Last question. This is a very smart audience. So between location A with least conflict impact, location B besieged hard to reach locations, you've chosen location B. Now, I'm not going to tell you the answer to this or if you're right or not right away. But what I am going to tell you is that Mercy Corps has completed a study in sites area that's specifically looking at how are households in sites area able to maintain or adapt their livelihoods among such a large humanitarian crisis. How are households still able to do that? Are there households that are still doing that? And that study will be published in January, so I'm going to ask you to watch that space to not just find out the answers to these, but a lot more nuance around that. And stop talking now. Thank you very much for listening to me. I hope you found that useful.